This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After a massive stroke on Wednesday, hours of surgery, and a medically induced coma, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was rushed back into surgery today after new bleeding in the brain. Barring a miracle, the long, indomitable Israeli leader is not now expected to return to the country's helm. After decades on Israel's front lines, in the Yom Kippur War, in Israel's invasion of Lebanon and its settlement policy, in sparking and quelling Palestinian intifada, in unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, Sharon has cast a huge and controversial shadow and had a huge influence on U.S. policy in the Middle East. Up next, On Point, Ariel Sharon, and now, Beyond. I want to turn now to William Quant. He joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's professor of politics at University of Virginia, former staff member of the National Security Council, very deeply involved in the negotiations that led to the Camp David Accords and the Egyptian-Israeli Peace Treaty. He's author of Peace Process, American Diplomacy, and the Arab-Israeli Conflict since 1967. William Quant, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
A lot to look at here, but your first thoughts as Ariel Sharon lies in such terrible medical trouble at the moment in Israel. Where does this leave the country, the region? What's the moment at which that's intersecting here with his, as Stephen Erlanger says, death watch?
Well, I guess it reminds me a bit of the shocking moment when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated just over 10 years ago, and all of a sudden you have to confront new realities very suddenly without many guidelines as to where things are likely to go. And of course, things turned out very differently in the aftermath of the Rabin assassination from what anyone would have expected in the few days after that tragic event. So I think we have to, first of all, acknowledge that looking very far into the future is very tricky right now. There are uncertainties about the domestic Israeli political scene. The political party that Sharon had just founded is a very uncertain vehicle without his leadership. That doesn't mean that it doesn't represent a certain quite important tendency in Israeli public opinion, and maybe that's what ultimately will really count. But it was really a one-man party. So that's a big question mark. The elections on not only the Israeli horizon are uncertain, but also whether or not the Palestinians will have their own elections in a couple of weeks. That's a decision that is a bit more up in the air, perhaps today, than it was before, but it was already uncertain. And then there's a question about American policy. We had pretty much, on the American side, opted for a disengaged stance, waiting for the Palestinians to have their elections, Israelis to have their elections. And then I think the attitude was, let's see where things stand there and see if we can be helpful. But we're not the driving force. All of a sudden, in the face of all these uncertainties, people are going to be asking, does Washington have a policy on any of these issues, particularly on whether the Palestinian election should go ahead in the circumstances where, of course, Hamas may do quite well, and that could complicate even further the chances for any kind of easing of Israeli-Palestinian relations.
None of us gets to choose our moment, but clearly Ariel Sharon would not have chosen this one in the midst of this large new direction that Steve Erlanger referred to, and you have as well, Bill Quant. How would you describe the kind of shifting of gears that Ariel Sharon was attempting to orchestrate here?
Sharon had begun to move in some really quite interesting ways. He had, several years ago, made clear soon after he became prime minister that he really didn't believe in something called a peace process, which meant sitting down and negotiating with the Palestinians and trying to reach agreements. That had been tried by Barak. It had failed. And he was clearly not going to go down that road, at least not willingly. And his alternative was not to just sit and do nothing. And I think this is where he was innovative. He said, we can do things as Israelis that make sense for us, and the Palestinians may not like it, but if it serves their interest, they will go along with it. And we can at least ease tensions, if not solve the conflict. I don't think he believed the conflict could be solved, at least not by mutual agreement. So I think what we were seeing was in the Gaza disengagement and pull out, the first sign of his unilateralist strategy of I'm going to do what makes sense for Israel, and new realities on the ground will define the relationship, but they're realities that we Israelis will set. Now, he had said that there would be no further unilateral steps after Gaza, but I don't think most people believed that. Mm-hmm. I think that was his political stance going into elections, knowing that there were lots of people who were worried about further steps. But I think most people look at the map and say that where the separation barrier, the wall, the fence, whatever you want to call it, was being constructed, and it's nearing completion. This, again, was one of his unilateral steps. That was what he thought of as the de facto separation line, call it a border, call it a boundary, between Israel and whatever the Palestinians wanted to call their area on the other side. And the missing piece in all of this is it would not have included something called peace. That is, there wouldn't have been a moment of formal reconciliation, signing peace treaties, recognition of Israel by the Palestinians, and vice versa. It just would have been an outcome. Now, I think that was both its strength. It didn't require a partner, but it was also the flaw. It meant that the Palestinians were never confronted with the need to come to terms with these realities. They were the kind of passive spectators of a play that was being designed and orchestrated entirely by Sharon. Now, that's going to be hard for anybody else to do.
We're joined right now from Jerusalem by Naomi Chazan, former member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament from 92 to 2003, member of the Meretz party. She is professor of political science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Naomi Chazan, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you again, Tom.
It's good to have you take us into this moment. How do you see Israelis dealing with this sudden fact in this week of Ariel Sharon clinging to life, it appears?
The mood of the country at the moment, the language is we're waiting for a miracle, we're praying, etc. So the situation is indeed very grim in terms of his health. I think during the past 48 hours, most Israelis have essentially been, I would say, sad on a more personal level. The mood here is somewhat as if one lost one's father. And that is a language that a lot of the pundits here in Israel are using, especially during the last few hours. I think this is something fairly natural given the circumstances. The most important thing politically, obviously, is what this will mean in terms of the future of Israel, especially since we're in the midst of an election season, and that will not change.
Ariel Sharon, over the years, controversial, polarizing, but now as he lies in the hospital, people looking to him as a father figure because he was always so strong, whether you agreed or disagreed, Naomi Chazan?
Very much. As you know very well, he, as far as I was concerned, he was always a bitter political rival, on the one hand. On the other hand, during the past year, and perhaps during the past 2 years, he succeeded in doing what the left talked about but was incapable of implementing. So even people like myself who disagreed with him very strongly and continue to disagree with various elements of his policy have to at least admit that he succeeded in withdrawing from Gaza, in dismantling settlements, which is something that nobody else succeeded in doing since 1967. So there's a mixture, I would say, of, in a sense, a real respect, even in the political opposition, and also a lot of talk at the moment, quite obviously, and again, quite naturally, about certain personality traits, his loyalty to friends, his concern with people, in a sense, his openness, which sounds surprising perhaps to your listeners, but it's not in the Israeli context.
Naomi, Bill Quant's been describing, and others have pointed to it as well, the sort of evolution of Ariel Sharon's thinking over the years with him in these last months, taking this new tack with Gaza, not toward negotiation with the Palestinians, which he gave up on, not toward the greater Israel vision, but toward a vision that might be symbolized by the barrier that's going up, nearly complete now, and a vision of separation from the Palestinians. Does that have buy-in from a majority of Israelis at this point? Does that need to be confirmed in an election result? Is it workable for the Israelis and Palestinians long-term to settle for separation?
Well, you asked three questions in one, so I'll try to separate them out. But let me start with whether there is a majority for Sharon's vision, which I think is fairly clear at this point. I didn't hear everything that Bill Kwan said, but I heard the tail end of it. Sharon's vision, very clearly, is of a mini-Palestinian state, not necessarily terribly viable, covering something in the neighborhood of 70% of the West Bank and all of Gaza. And the second element of the vision is that this kind of outcome will be achieved by further unilateral measures. In other words, what many think that Sharon had in mind, and I subscribe to that, is essentially an exercise in long-term conflict management as opposed to conflict resolution. I would say that that position has a clear majority in Israel today. All the polls are showing that about 50% of the population subscribe to that vision. A further 25-30% would like to see a viable Palestinian state, the end of the conflict, achieved by negotiation. And those are people that you will find in Labor and to the left of Labor, in Meretz and other small parties to the left. And there is still a group of what, for lack of a better term, one has to call refuseniks, about, again, 25%, who think that no kind of separation is acceptable and that no kind of solution is possible. So as to your question about whether there is a majority for the Sharon position, my answer would be yes. And then that leads us into your second question. Does one need elections? It's not a question of needing elections to confirm this or not. We are formally in election period. Mm-hmm. The election period started about 10 days ago. And therefore, there will be elections on the 28th of March, barring any other unforeseen circumstances. The question is whether Sharon's new party, which is fairly uninstitutionalized, and the list for the parliament has not even been agreed upon, because Sharon himself was supposed to arrange it, put it in order, whether that party could garner what Sharon himself was gaining in the polls, which is something about one-third of the next Knesset, which would make it the largest party by far in Israel. His successor at the moment, or his replacement and probable successor, is Ehud Olmert. Today's polls in Israel show him doing as well at the head of the party as Sharon would have done, but that's a poll that reflects the mood of the country, and I don't think that one should take that very seriously.
Bill Quant, can you see Sharon's separation policy between negotiation and having it all moving ahead without a Kadima victory? Is that going to be necessary to cement it, and does that look possible to you?
You know, if Kadima doesn't succeed in getting something like the third of the Knesset seats that Naomi mentioned, the alternative is going to be a weak coalition government patched together from several different political tendencies, and that's not a good formula for successful steps that are likely to be controversial. So little things could no doubt be done by that kind of a government, but any sort of forceful move, either unilaterally or in negotiations, would seem to me to require a stronger leader and a stronger government. So I think we're going to be in a period where leadership is untested, where the government is more likely to be relatively weak. We should remember that since Rabin's assassination, the next couple of governments under Netanyahu and under Barak both ended up being so weak that they had to call early elections because they couldn't continue to govern. And that kind of a pattern is not impossible. Sharon had broken that pattern. He was a relatively strong figure, and had he been elected again, or his party been elected again this coming March, I think he could have moved forward with what we think his strategy was. But whether a successor with a weaker mandate, with a weaker profile, could do as well, I really am skeptical. But it remains to be seen. I think the fact that, as Naomi said, about half the Israelis would support some further steps toward separation does at least open the possibility for some kind of continued movement in that direction.
But leaving Israel kind of midstream, as Ariel Sharon appears to be leaving the political stage. Naomi Chazan, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
I want to get a Palestinian perspective here, or a journalist's perspective. Joining us from Beirut in Lebanon is Rami Khoury, Palestinian-Jordanian syndicated columnist, editor-at-large at the Daily Star in Lebanon. Rami Khoury, thank you very much for being with us. Your thoughts on the legacy of Ariel Sharon?
I think it is a complex legacy, but seen from the perspective of the rest of the Middle East, it is largely a negative one. He's a kind of a tragic hero, in a sense. He certainly is heroic and pioneering and bold, courageous, charismatic, flamboyant, daring, all of these things in the eyes of the Israelis, which is predominantly an image from his military tactical days. Mm-hmm. I think when you analyze the net results of his actual policies, and he's held many ministerial posts, including prime minister, the net result is pretty thin. He's tragic in the sense that he could never fully stop being a warrior, and he kept fighting the Palestinians in different ways, and most recently by saying the Arabs of East Jerusalem couldn't vote, that he wouldn't speak to Hamas even if they did well in the election. So I think it's a very mixed but largely a negative legacy, and the results on the ground of his policies are not very impressive. He's dazzling as a tactician, but he is pretty, I think he's got a poor record in terms of results, and the main one being that he's fought all his life to get the security and acceptance of the Israeli people in the Middle East, and that is now further away than ever, and the results of his policies are bringing to power Islamist groups all over the Middle East. And remember, Hamas and Hezbollah are grandchildren of Sharon's policies in Lebanon and the West Bank. You would not have had Hamas and Hezbollah if it wasn't for people like Ariel Sharon. So we need to be honest and detached, I think, in complete and assessing his legacy. I still feel, as a Palestinian, that there is a majority in Israel, 50, 60, 70%, there is a clear majority that is willing to make reasonable compromises in return for acceptance, security, and living a normal life. And I think the opportunity is there. Sharon was not the man to seize it. He shattered that opportunity by going the unilateral and the military route. Unilateralism may have made the Israelis feel better. It shattered the peace process, and we need to get back to a negotiation that leads to a two-state solution and coexistence. And I think it's possible, but you need also much stronger external intervention. So one option is to bring Bill Quant back into office.
There's the word from Beirut. Rami Khoury, editor-at-large at the Daily Star in Lebanon, very glad to have you. Thank you for joining us. I want to turn to Jerusalem and Jonathan Speier, a longtime Likud party activist, served in the Sharon government, was deputy was press officer under Benjamin Netanyahu to one of the deputy ministers there, a loyalist to Sharon in his shift to the center. He's now a fellow at the Center for Global Research and International Affairs in Israel. Jonathan Speier, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Kadima, are you shifting to it? Do you think Israel will go for it if Sharon's not there to lead it?
Well, this is, of course, the big question right now. Let's understand what's happening in policy terms. In order for this shift towards unilateralism to work, it has to demonstrate results. Now, we got to the possibility of unilateralism because Sharon came to power in February 2001 in the midst of the ruins of a peace process, based on illusion, in my opinion, that peace process, and in the midst of an attack upon us by the forces of the Palestinian Authority. Now, Sharon succeeded, through sometimes controversial means, in shutting down that attack on Israel, in defeating it, through a combination of factors, the security barrier, the use of targeted killings, and other means. Now, what it meant was that we got to a point where we could begin to conduct a controlled experiment, which went the following way. Guys, we said to the Palestinians, we're leaving Gaza. It's up to you now. If you can show us, and you can show the world too, and the international community too, that you can run Gaza, and it can work, and we're not getting missiles rained down upon us, that has implications and it can mean further withdrawals. Right now, we are in the midst of that process. It seems to me that if Ehud Olmert, now the acting prime minister, can show that Gaza has worked, in other words, he can stop the Qassam rockets that have been falling over the last few days, it'll help him win the elections, when he goes to elections in March, and if things in Gaza have worked, then we're looking at the possibility of unilateralism being a successful move, and then we could see the possibility of further unilateral moves. If it doesn't, if we show that when we're not in Gaza, it's just not quiet, it's just chaos, and missiles are flying at western Negev Israeli communities, then I very much doubt there's going to be many more unilateral moves.
Bill Quandt, we hear opposite views here from Jonathan Spire and Rami Khoury in a way. What about it, the unilateral approach, the negotiated approach? You've been in this for a long time. Will Sharon's final trajectory be a workable one here or not?
I don't think it's going to lead to a formal peace, and that's the real problem. It might have, as an interim step, created a calmer atmosphere in which eventually a real peace could have been negotiated. But I think your recent caller is right, that the ultimate goal, if we want to see a more peaceful Middle East, is to see Israelis and Palestinians negotiate a termination of the conflict, not to simply have it subside on a de facto basis with the possibility that it can always flare up again as it has in the past. I think there's a lot to be said for keeping the goal a negotiated peace settlement between the two sides. Along the way, there may be opportunities for unilateral steps to create conditions that make peace negotiations easier. I think the withdrawal from Gaza was one of those. But it's not a substitute for peace, in my view.
And with that, we're going to have to let it go for the moment as Ariel Sharon and his doctors go on with their struggle. Jonathan Spire in Jerusalem, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
And William Quandt at the University of Virginia, long time, in the middle of U.S. relations in this region. Bill Quandt, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being
here.
Nice
to be with you.
This is On Point.